I'm Bill Teeple, and I'm here with Alan Cobb and Donna Colby, and this is Icon Art Radio. You've been reading the book about the culinary life of artists. What's the name of the book?
The book is called The Artist Palette, P-A-L-E-T-E, and it was published by DK Publishing Company. If you know that, they're very wonderfully and lavishly illustrated books of all sorts. And I just stumbled upon it when I was buying something else on the internet, and suddenly this book came up, and it was no question, I just had to get this book, because the book is pictures of many great artists that we know, contemporary and a little, you know, as far back as Matisse, and their favorite recipes or favorite meals. And sometimes they'll leave, like one of the pictures is even Calder in his kitchen among his pots and pans, where the pots and pans are hanging down in his actual kitchen, looking as artistic as his mobiles. And so I got this cookbook and started actually using it as a cookbook and following these recipes. And after doing it a few times, I realized, this is really a trip. This is very quirky, what they have done here, because it wasn't that they tried to find the most seriously good recipes that these artists had access to or had liked, but they found something that was very typical of that artist. Like, for example, one of the stories was about someone who went over to Edward Hopper's house for dinner one night, and this was the meal. And this meal was the menu included in this cookbook on the page about Edward Hopper. The meal was Campbell's tomato soup, Nabisco saltine crackers, and Sanka coffee, which is a perfect Edward Hopper symbolic meal. But it actually happened. Somebody actually went over to his house, and that was what they served. The Francis Picabia recipe in the book was 8 eggs, 1 cup of butter, and you cook it for a half an hour in a saucepan. And it said at the bottom of this recipe, you have to do it this way. You can't cook it in a skillet. You can't cook it for less than a half an hour. You can't use less butter. You can use more butter if you want to. But this, you know, you have to do it this way or it won't work.
You have to see your cardiologist immediately afterwards.
But, you know, you read that, and knowing Francis Picabia, you don't know if that's a total put-on, if even the recipe is just a total put-on, or if he actually made this and ate it.
People ask me what you know my favorite food is, and it's usually at a time when we're already eating things, and I always think, well, just boil it down to the essentials. Take a bathtub, fill it with lard, put a couple hundred pounds of sugar in it, stir, and then jump in.
Right, right.
It's the two essential food groups.
So, and anyway, just I'm going to give you a couple more examples, and then we can leap off this into any direction we want. But I thought there was a very sweet one, which was Rothko. They asked relatives of Rothko what his favorite food was, and they said, absolutely, no question about it, every year on his birthday he wanted apple pie with raisins and walnuts. That was by far his favorite food. And then also one of my favorite parts of the book was a recipe for fish soup by Matisse that's very precise, and it was the reason, or the way they got access to this, was that he had actually written this recipe in a letter to a friend, and they show in the book a photograph of the actual letter with his little drawings around it and the recipe for this fish soup, which had some kind of fish in it. I don't know if it specified the kind. Leeks, tomato, fennel, and orange peel were the ingredients in Matisse's fish soup. They also, in the cookbook, have little short bios or stories about the artist in case you don't know who they are, and it gives you a context. It's a wonderful book, and I've actually made several recipes. And the thing that's interesting about, I haven't made the Picabia one, but the thing that's interesting about making these recipes and eating this food is you actually feel this magical connection with that artist and that artist's world when you sit down to eat these meals.
What do you suppose happens to 8 eggs and a pound of butter in a saucepan?
I'm curious.
It like a souffle? I mean, would it just sort of boil up into a big you know, solidified?
Or was he putting us on?
Where was it found,
the recipe? That recipe, did they describe?
From Peccavia? I don't remember, but it apparently came directly from Peccavia. It was probably some thing he had written down or told.
But
to
the
a
question
friend or
in my
like
mind
that.
Is, did is that what yeah, he actually
was he
did?
Serious?
Or was he
serious?
Putting us on? Because he was a goddess, so
he would have. But
yeah.
Well,
that's what made me think of, you know, lard and sugar. Why right. Why complicate matters? Just mix the sugar into the lard, shove it into your face.
Well, all this brings up to my mind that
Crisco,
art
if you're
making
a vegetarian.
And living the what we discussed in our last show, the playful life, living the playful life, is non-stopping for these artists. Like, he doesn't stop making art when he leaves the studio and has to then do, you know, mundane, serious things. We were talking last time about this life of the artist being an exploration. That if you take it too serious and you try to get it right every time, you're only going to end up like probably not being a very good artist. And these great artists are living, they're riding a wave of the exhilaration of life itself. And these kinds of people are creative people, which means they're constantly exploring. And every aspect of their life is filled with that sort of wonder. There's one, like, you feel a sense of wonder. And if you don't have it already, if you start looking at great art, wonder will grow in your soul. But this wonder is a component in these lives. And when you read, see, I love to read about their everyday life, or I like to hear quotes from them, or see an interview, or anything that gives a glimpse of all the aspects of an artist's life, because for me, it makes a greater whole and it makes the work even richer. Mm. But you also see, you get a clue as what it is to live a balanced life, the way you should live, and where everything is wonder, everything is exploration, everything is the beauty of life. Mm. And
right.
So that when you hear about what they like to eat and stuff, or it seems yes, you feel this yes, right, about each one, but it's also you feel a connection with someone who's doing it right, who's living life as it should be lived, and everything is fun.
Yeah, and it doesn't, like here in this particular book, it's looking at their likes and dislikes in food, and but you can also find, like, some of my favorite books are the photography books by David Douglas Duncan, who photographed Picasso at home in his later years, and they're just wonderful black and white photographs, most of them black and white, a few color, and half the fun of looking at it is to see what Picasso is wearing in each picture, because he could be wearing like plaid pants tucked into striped knee socks, or wearing like just a little pair of lime green shorts or something like that. And there are all sorts of outfits that he would put on. And then the other thing that was wonderful about these books is the rooms, that every room was essentially a studio, even if he didn't have his easel. He might have had his easel set up in some particular spot, but the other rooms always had projects, like he found some wood in the junkyard and just banged it together, and then there was a little group of these funny little sculptures on the buffet, you know, or he decided he was going to work with ink and do, you know, experiments with a certain kind of paper, and then over on this table there's a pile of all of those that are in progress. And everywhere you look, there's something like that, where you could almost just feel the energy that he just kind of got an idea of, like, oh, what if I do this with this? Let's try it. And he just like did it right then, instead of thinking, I'll put that on my list and do it later when I'm in my studio. It was just right there.
And I think one of the great lessons of Picasso is this idea of going for it and no fear. Mm-hmm. You know, people should study Picasso just to liberate them and give them permission.
Yeah, that was actually my motivation when I first got interested in Picasso, when I was too tight of an artist. In my early art classes that I took in high school, you were, you know, back in my school, the art teacher wanted you to do very careful, realistic drawings, you know. So I was very good at doing a pencil drawing of a person with all the muscles shaded perfectly and the wrinkles in a blanket or something like that. But at a certain point, when I went to RISD, I had one drawing teacher who made me tie my pencil to the end of a yardstick and stand up and draw to get out of that little careful habit. And I hated it at first. But when I started reading about Picasso, just reading for like 10 minutes about his creative attitudes and vitality and all, my body would change and I would feel like capable of taking a wide paintbrush and dipping it in some paint and making a bold line across a canvas. And I think that is why he's a valuable artist to look up to. Even if you don't like his actual paintings, a lot of people don't like his actual paintings, but really admire his creative vitality and curiosity. They all of those artists as well, I mean any artist, not just that era, but any artist, even if they come from a different relationship to life than Picasso had, come from that level that we were talking about last week as inquisitiveness. Paul Klee, for example, is another example of somebody who was inspired by nature and inspired by music, and in his very careful way, his approach was very different from Picasso's because he came from the Swiss culture, which is much more regimented. And, you know, he kept everything all neatly organized. Everything was documented and his studio was neat and all of that. But his level of inquisitiveness and desire to explore something came from the same place, even though it manifested in a different way.
I'm reminded of an experience I had when I was living in Switzerland, actually many experiences. It seemed as though one of the most common expressions that I heard uttered by the Swiss people that I was doing business with was, "That is very difficult." And it's because I was coming from an American viewpoint, which says, there's an obstacle, well, let's figure out how to knock it down. And if we can't knock it down, then let's go around it. And if we can't go around it, let's figure out a way to go under it. And the Swiss mentality, and I don't mean to be putting down the Swiss, I admire them tremendously in other areas, but it's like if there's an obstacle, the attitude seems to be there's supposed to be an obstacle and it's supposed to stop you. And if you don't honor that, you're making a terrible mistake. One time I was picking someone up at the Bahnhof in Luzern, and it was 2 o'clock in the morning. There was not a vehicle moving on any street as far as the eye could see throughout the city of Luzern. And I was on one side of this broad boulevard in front of the train station, and I was waiting for the light, and I thought, why am I waiting for the light? There's no one here, and there's no cars. So I stepped off the curb, and there was a little old lady standing a few feet away from me, and she jumped into the street, pulled me back onto the sidewalk, and with a little smile on her face, because she felt she was helping me. She wasn't, you know, being officious about it. She was helping me out, because obviously I didn't realize what I was doing, because there was a no crossing, you know, sign lit up, and only, you know, a person would never do that intentionally. It had to be a mistake. And so I ended up thanking her and, you know, waiting for the ridiculous light to change, which, you know, took another couple of minutes because it was a complex intersection. But it shows, you know, this sort of difference in taking things seriously and then trying to be playful. But it's very difficult. It makes it hard on you if you're supposed to follow the rules, and playfulness says, maybe not this time. Mm. And it just can't be allowed. In fact, not to pick on the Swiss, but there was another instance where we were taking the lake boats around Lucerne from city to city. Actually, we were kind of commuting on lake boats for a while, and one day the boat was being was a training vessel, and they had some student boatmen on board, and this great big boat, you know, with capable of holding hundreds of people and a couple of stories tall, pulls up to a dock, and the trainee boatman throws the rope over the pier post, and the trainee pilot puts the engine in reverse and doesn't do it in time, and the boat keeps going forward and doesn't slow down fast enough, and the rope gets tighter and tighter and tighter, and the dock starts leaning a little bit. Then there's this loud pop and the rope breaks in two, and the seasoned boatman, you know, hasten to correct the situation. We get to the next dock. Same thing happens. The boatman doesn't have the timing right on the lever, and he doesn't stop in time, and the rope breaks. We get to the third dock, and the boatmen are now hauling out the nylon rope, which is like 2 inches in diameter, blue nylon, and they throw that over the piling. And the guy's going, you know, for the book says you go ahead 1/4, then you go astern 1/4, then ahead 1/8 for a count of three or something like that. And he's trying to do it right, and the rope stretches and stretches and stretches, and there's this huge pop and this cloud of blue fiber all over the place. And we get to the fourth or fifth dock, and the boatmen down below are trying to moor the boat to each of these docks. Come out with the steel cable, and as we approach the dock, they throw this steel cable over to the guy on the dock, and he throws it over the piling. And the boatman, the beginning student trainee boatman, is like going ahead, going astern, going ahead, and going astern, and just getting it entirely wrong. And this steel cable, of course, is not going to break, and the dock gets cranked up out of the water at about a 20 degree angle, you know, and the passengers are all scurrying back to land. And finally, the boat stops, because the dock stops it pretty much, and they managed to get us moored again and take on passengers. But at the same time that this was going on, we were watching, you could see the boatman, he's up in this little, you know, thing sticking out up on the upper deck, and you can see this young guy. And he's looking at what's going on, and he's obviously under tremendous pressure, and he has to get the procedure right. And the impression we got was that if by any chance he had been trying to ride a bicycle following a procedure, he would have obviously just fallen over every time. Because you learn something that way. You got to get the feel of the thing. And it just seemed like he was going by the book instead of going by the situation. Mm. And the book just wasn't adequate. And, that's, I guess there's something universal in that.
Well, and I suppose...
Well, if we're going to talk about art making, we can easily go there.
Yeah, right.
Yes, and you can, all the Swiss friends in our listening audience can send your angry letters to KRUU.
Well, the good thing about this aspect of the Swiss is that's why they make such good watches
and
machines and things like that. So I think every culture has a purpose in the mix of all of the cultures on Earth, but and also their transportation systems are always on time. I missed a Swiss Air flight one time because my previous flight getting into New York was delayed due to a thunderstorm, and when we landed in New York, they rushed me and my friend, you know, over to the Swiss Air terminal, you know, raced us over there, realizing that we were actually going to make it with 2 minutes to spare. So we did. We got there to the gate, 2 minutes to spare. But they had shut the door on the plane, and the plane was still going to sit there for another 2 minutes, but they wouldn't let us on the plane because that's the rule.
Yeah, you close the door 2 minutes before.
You just, you know, that's it.
Yeah.
And so we were saying, but, you know, and going our whole, like, no.
Yeah.
Nope, we wouldn't. And so then we got shifted over to a KLM flight, and that took us into Amsterdam, and we were going to Zurich, and then we had to, like, catch some other plane to Zurich. Meanwhile, we had no idea what was happening to our luggage through all this, you know, how we were ever going to find it. You know, we didn't know if it was on the Swiss airplane or if where in the world it was. And we arrived, and also we couldn't notify anybody of our friends, you know, as to this change in plans. We arrived in Zurich. Our friends were there to pick us up with our luggage. And it was somehow the Swiss Air, between the Swiss Air people and the KLM people, they had gotten it there.
Yeah.
So,
and it was probably the Swiss.
It was probably the Swiss.
So it was certain that
it was the there was the drawback of them not letting us on the flight, but then there was also the advantage that through their efficiency and organization they had somehow managed to get the word through to
In all the years that I commuted in and out of Salisbury, it was probably over much of a 5-year period. Every single time I took the funicular down to the shore of the lake boat was pulling into the dock at that very moment, every single time.
Yeah.
Well, there's a comfort in that.
Absolutely, it's great.
It's well,
great.
It's
nice to know that something
we sort
is
of,
being
I mean, here
done
in America,
right.
we sort of like, we make you feel better about things. And America is nothing if you go to some South American countries.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Or India. but I think all of this brings up the point that it's always a balance, you know, that we do need order in our lives. It's not just a free-for-all. You know, when we talk about play, it doesn't mean throwing away all order and everything else.
Right.
You know, it's a matter of creating this balance of everything. And there is order in nature, even though there's also great flexibility. And I think this comfort that you were talking about, you know, when things are regimented to that degree, is why people become fundamentalists of any sort, you know, of any field of knowledge or religion or anything. There are people who really like the form to be so clear-cut that this is right, this is wrong, period. You know, there's no variation because there's some, they feel comfortable within those boundaries.
There's some risk in uncertainty. I mean, there's some unpleasantness in uncertainty.
Right.
If you don't feel safe inside, then you don't want to entertain too many possibilities because they're all probably dangerous.
Right, yeah. So there's... And I think that's going circling back to what we talked about at the beginning of the last show about this attitude in the aristocratic Japanese, where the language form was that I am playing at being a businessman or playing at going to, you know, catching the train or something like that. It allows you to do both simultaneously.
It does, because a game well played is an accurately played game.
Right. You can't enjoy a game that you're playing with somebody if you throw the rules out and just everybody's doing whatever they want. Yeah. And things like gardening, for example. You can read a gardening manual and follow it by the letter, and something doesn't all necessarily work out because you're not being present and observing in your own backyard what's happening and how the soil feels and all of that. But at the same time, you could be just doing that, following your intuition, and miss something entirely because you can't tell what the pH of the soil is, or you know, whatever. So it's a juggling act of all of these
totally
facets of life.
I had a thought, but it's eluded me here. let's loop back to the food thing. Mm-hmm. I'd like you to say a few words about this thing in regard to your life and your art form, because I think your art form, besides the paintings you do and the writing that you do, is the way you live your life and the way you make meals and the way you put your house together.
Okay. Well,
because I mean, in other words, we should have, you should be in the book too.
It was definitely the main motivation for buying a house was to have the house be an art project. And that it was just so much fun. And my son Dane, by the way, and his girlfriend are wanting a house right now to do the same thing to, although theirs will look different from mine. But it really is that way, and I've always been that way in regarding rooms, that no matter where I am in the room, looking from every vantage point, it must be a work of art. So, you know, moving things around, changing colors and things like that. And the same thing with my meals. It has to look beautiful and be on the right color plate and have, you know, a certain color placemat and things like that, even if I'm eating all by myself, because it enhances the whole experience of life to that value is important to me, and it enhances the whole experience of life to live that way for me. It's worth it.
So it's your whole life is sort of an aesthetic experience. And it's not that you're doing it necessarily for, that's an interesting point. You're not necessarily doing it for others. You're pleasing your aesthetic sense at every turn.
That's right.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.